Welcome back to The Short Code, a podcast of wit and wisdom from the students of the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine. I'm co-executive producer Dave Etler. In this episode, we'll hear about Anatomy Lab. Students Nicholas Bedard and Brittany Anderson and professors Mark Pizzamenti and Darren Hoffman will talk about this exciting and interesting component of a first-year student's medical education. It's also part of medical school that can have an emotional impact on both students and educators as they consider issues of life, death, and the devotion to medical education of those who choose to donate their bodies to science. Then Paul Christine will talk with students and faculty about Research Day, when medical students that have done research present their work to their peers and faculty of the Carver College of Medicine. Finally, we've got a new segment we're calling The Short Couch, in which students can ask for advice from their peers. If you'd like your question answered, visit our website at theshortcoat.com. This time, host Natalie Ramirez, along with Chris Yop and Amy Domeyer, will answer a student's questions about how to balance life with studying. Enjoy!
Well, Dr. Pizzamenti, can you start off maybe just kind of setting the scene for us, discussing the D2Body ceremony, or not necessarily the D2Body program and what it does for us both as students in the learning environment, as well as maybe some of the, I guess, more emotional or kind of close to home issues that may arise with the whole idea of learning off of actual donors.
Sure, Nick. The University of Iowa and Carver College of Medicine is fortunate because we have a community that will subscribe to the D2Body program. What that allows, as you may not be aware, medical gross anatomy is only one course that's offered through the Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology. We have a full dissection course for physician's assistants, for physical therapists, for dental students. So a number of cadavers are used in our anatomic studies. And we're able to do that only by the donations of the general public, and that is willing their body for anatomic and scientific purposes. For the medical gross anatomy course that you've gone through, if you recall, we had 25 donors that were part of that group. And that means with 150 students, you're working about six students per donor. So as you go through your course, six of you as a group are making study on one person's remains. Now, what that allows us to do is it allows not only as you're doing that study, but also to explore the dissections that are completed at other tables. So you get to see in that a variety. So in part, that helps, I guess, and how I see it, is viewing human anatomy not as just one donor, but actually as a number through a particular course. Now, that's just the basic study. Now, of course, the other side of that, which is your introductory comment, is what from the student side do students have to deal with? And there are, I suspect, a number of emotional aspects that go into the study of human anatomy, particularly when you're using cadaveric material, donor material, to be part of a professional program. What I guess how I would start to ask or answer that question is to ask you, what were some of the emotions that you may have felt when you not started anatomy, but when you just went through the orientation and you were down in the lab for the first time, remembering that with 150 students, maybe a handful have previously done dissection, but it's a number more than likely have taken an anatomy course without dissection. What were some of the emotions you may have been experiencing, or if you could share anything that your colleague shared with you at that time? I think that would be an important place to start the discussion.
Well, my name's Brittany, and I have in the past I've taken some comparative anatomy classes, but never anything that was with a donor body. However, I worked for 3 years as a recovery technician for the Iowa Lions Eye Bank. So I, for 3 years, was doing donor recoveries on corneas for transplant with real cadavers. And in that sense, I mean, our time limit was 20 hours out from the time of death. So ours were non-preserved bodies, and they were usually in either an OR or down in the morgue or in some place where the body had not been, there was no prep work or anything. So it was kind of the whatever was in their dying moment. That's how we saw the body. So it was, I've had a lot of experience in previous years seeing a lot more things than just in an actual anatomy lab. So I felt very prepared going in, and emotionally very prepared, because I remember my first time just seeing an MVA and how that kind of took a toll on me and everything. But as far as for school related goes, I felt pretty good about it, and so I was very thankful, I guess, for that previous experience.
But yeah, I guess I kind of have a slightly different approach to it. I had some experience with cadavers in undergrad, but it was very limited. It was an anatomy course, and we toured the med school cadaver lab and kind of looked at some of the muscles and stuff. But they were already, almost fully dissected by that point. And so it's odd how, kind of less human you recognize them when you get to that point. Like, you look at it more as almost like a learning tool, which it is, but it's almost at that point not as much different than like just a model. And so I think what was different for me when I did get to med school and being down there, especially during orientation, and being in the first dissection group, so kind of starting the whole process from the first cut, I think one of the biggest emotions for me was sort of a apprehension or hesitation, because you feel like how much is going to help you. Like, you understand how much you're going to learn from it, how much better you're going to know your anatomy from actually seeing it and seeing the anomalies and seeing the differences. But you also kind of feel hesitant because in the back of your mind you realize like what you're doing to another person. And so I think that was the hardest thing, was getting used to, like, I guess being kind of, sometimes you have to be a little more aggressive in some of the dissections, and sometimes you have to be kind of not as gentle as you would be if you're thinking about like how you would treat someone else, or if you're doing surgery on someone. And so I think that was one of the biggest transitions for me, is just kind of getting over the apprehension and the hesitation of what you're doing. It wasn't as much getting used to the fact that it was a human, because if you focus on the fact that this person donated their body for you, like, and to not use it or to not like get everything you can out of it, you're almost kind of doing a disservice to them. And so I think if you kept that as your kind of focal point, it wasn't as hard getting used to like working on the actual human cadavers. But I think it was kind of getting over the idea of how you had to somewhat kind of treat them in some of the dissections. And so it's just a matter of realizing that this was a gift someone gave you, and to kind of reject the gift would be no different than rejecting any other gift, except this is quite a bigger magnitude one. So
if I can follow up on your point, Nick, this is Dr. Hoffman. I think that you raise a really important point about dissection that's very unique to the learning experience, in that it's an uncovery process as much as it is a discovery process. It's one thing to walk into an anatomy situation where everything's dissected for you and you're really just looking and taking it all in, whereas and the part of the dissection experience is a systematic process of taking something apart from its total form, which is recognizable, emotional, and real, to breaking it down to smaller, learnable pieces. And the ultimate goal is that you learn those pieces, but also the ultimate goal of your medical education is to understand how it fits in the context of the whole person. And I have a hard time imagining a better way to teach both things at the same time than through that sort of gradual uncovery process.
Currently, how we have it set up is students will get very limited information about the donor. What information we have is the information that they provide for us at the time of signing up for the program, and students will also know the cause of death, the sex, the gender, and the age. They do get some information, but not a detailed medical history. Those that information is not provided to us. At the time of enrollment in the program, donors will complete a form that asks if they've had previous surgeries or cancers, and if at that time those are noted, we will have that information. Kind of requirements that we have, communicable diseases usually disqualifies someone from participating in the donor program.
I think you'd be surprised that there's less of the extreme, swooning, passing out reactions. I think a lot of students come in expecting that it's going to be really emotionally overwhelming, and they're almost sure that they're going to pass out. And it really very rarely happens that somebody has that extreme of a reaction. I think part of it is the approach that we use, which is a sort of down to business. All right, let's go. There's no time for you to become too overwhelmed. You have things to do today. I think that helps. But I think that in every medical student, there's a certain fascination that your intellect is just as stimulated as your emotions are. And I think that carries a lot of people through, just that curiosity about what's next and what's the next step in the process and what am I going to learn next.
And as Dr. Hoffman mentioned, there's seldom do we have those severe reactions of, people fainting, or there have been instances where students have left the lab, and usually I or another faculty member will follow them just to ensure that they're okay. Students, if they're open to it, can be consoled and told, discuss anything that they would be willing to share at that moment, but usually that's not the moment that they want to do the sharing. We also, as part of the orientation process, have students at least have an opportunity to explore that potential. When I became course director, there was a student request that students could be introduced into the lab in a more, I wouldn't say formal, maybe informal is a better word, and given an opportunity to explore some of the issues that, the discussion has alluded to, and that is, how are you feeling when you come into the lab? What emotions are with you? Is your intellect piqued? Is your curiosity piqued? But do you still have some apprehension? And to help students kind of navigate through that, we instituted, as part of the orientation, down in the lab, they would actually meet some of the upper classmates. So M2s would actually come down to the lab and be at the tables. And during the orientations, the incoming students would be able to ask these M2s questions. And sometimes those questions revolved around, so how did you feel? What do I need to prepare for? To help the M2s prepare to do that, we kind of meet with them the night before and explore some of the issues that they may have had when they went into the anatomy lab, whether it was, their curiosity, their apprehension, their fear that they might recognize one of the donors. Those were issues that incoming students could discuss with their M2 classmates or upper classmates that maybe incoming students wouldn't be comfortable discussing with a faculty member on day one of medical school. But there is an opportunity for students to do that.
I know also, in addition to that, we have at the same semester, we have what's called like personal and professional development small groups. And I know in my small group, that first week when we met, we didn't have a whole lot to discuss other than introduction. So a lot of it was based on how we felt that first week in anatomy lab and kind of explored a lot of the feelings and emotional things that may be going on. And so that also helped a lot and to kind of, get everyone to come to grips with that this was it was a learning experience, and that we were going to be able to gain as much out of it as we could.
Can I ask a question to the students? I've found in pretty much every semester I've ever taught anatomy that the students' emotional responses are, I mean, maybe more intense or stronger later on in the semester when you're doing a particular dissection, that for some reason something about that part of the body resonates with you as a person. And I have my ideas about what the big areas that always are, but I'd be curious what your experiences were if you sort of had a emotionally charged moment in the lab.
Yeah, definitely. I think, especially for me, because my only previous experience with cadavers were like pre-dissected. And so for me, I guess it was when we got to the like upper extremity portion of the dissection, and specifically, I guess, the hand, just because if you think about it, you can tell a lot about a person from their hand. So like, I remember a particular artist was a female donor, and her fingernails still had some of the nail polish on them. And you could just kind of, you know, the way that her hands had formed, like the kind of lack of calluses, like different kinds of things. You can tell something about a person about how they live their life, I think. And so I don't know if it wasn't as much, or if it was like, it was emotional, but not in the fact that like it was upsetting, but it's more so kind of like you had such a relationship built with this cadaver, this donor, throughout the whole dissection process and learning from them. But then it's kind of like they kind of started giving back to you in sort of a more, I guess, human way, you know, instead of just like a structural, like anatomy studying way. And so it was kind of cool. It was not as much like, you know, sad or disheartening, but it was sort of like a way that you find out more about this person that you never actually met in your entire life, but you start to learn about them. So I thought that was probably the most emotionally charged part of the dissection for me.
Sure.
I know, family members in the past that have passed away of certain diseases, like seeing some of those kind of things being physically expressed and seeing what that actually looks like inside a human being is kind of emotionally charged. I know some of my family members, then you see, okay, so this is what their body actually looked like inside when they were going through this disease. And so that part, I think, was probably my hardest part and when I got the most kind of emotionally connected or whatever. But
each year, and I can't remember the number that we're at.
I don't know. It's been a while.
A number, decades, where we have had a deeded body ceremony, and this ceremony pays tribute to those who have donated this wonderful gift, thinking not so much of themselves or their family members, but what this gift could do for professional training and the study of anatomy. And this is done every year. We honor those who have participated in the previous year's courses. We, at that ceremony, students are allowed and are encouraged to have a representative from each of the professional programs that have participated in a course of study over the previous year, and will give some reflection on what that course and the issues related to the course in studying not only anatomy but also dealing with some of the emotion or affective aspects of their study over the course of the year. And they share that openly with the family members. And I think it's such a beautiful ceremony because I can only imagine a family member just listening to those words and saying, this is what that gift did. And I think after hearing such eloquent words just this past ceremony, it, you know, makes me kind of touched in a way that to see how the study not only of the structures and the relationships but also the effective part just comes through with the students as they share their experiences and their thanks with the families that participate. So I think it's a great ceremony and something that we've done for a number of years here. And I might add, is emulated at other institutions.
Could I just open up one other sort of line of discussion? I think one thing that's really interesting about learning anatomy, and particularly through learning anatomy from a cadaver, is sort of the self-reflective self-learning that happens at the same time. I know that for me, learning anatomy is as much about learning about myself as it is about learning about patients or other people or this abstract subject. And I think that for me, learning anatomy was one of the first times that I felt like that I'm okay the way that I am, because my body works and that's good enough. And so sort of an interesting sort of self-discovery can come out of the process of studying someone else. I think you realize that everybody is more alike than different. Within an anatomy lab, yeah, there's variation. There's 25 different people, but in general, all the rules are the same in everybody's bodies. And I think there's something really interesting and connecting about that experience. And I don't know if you guys had any sort of feelings along those lines as students in through anatomy study.
No, I think that's a really good point. I think you find out how, like, uniquely, this is almost exactly what you said, but how uniquely connected we all are. Like, you look on the surface, or just, you know, mentally, you see all different aspects of people. You see different personalities, you see different talents and all this, and we always are focused on how people are different or what kind of, like, categories they fall in. But then when you kind of get down to it, like, just like, you know, the anatomical structures is looking, everyone falls in the same category. Like, we're all human, we all have these exact same relationships, you know. There's always this, the structure is always found here or next to this thing. Like, it's just, if you kind of step back and step away from the whole big picture, you see how uniquely connected we are. And then it kind of, I don't know, it kind of brings it home, because not only are you learning about, you know, variations within people, and that's what's important a lot when it comes to, you know, becoming a doctor and, like, diagnosing problems, you're looking for the differences from the norm, but really you're looking for the differences in order to, like, get this person back to the normal. So it's like, I think it's just important to both recognize the differences, but then look back at the big picture and see how we all are kind of one same person almost. So.
Well, I wanted to just say one last thing, and I think it's important because it's touched on all of the issues that we've discussed here this afternoon, and it's the added, I guess, professionalism that can be associated with the study of anatomy. And in fact, there was an open letter to first-year medical students by Dr. Cantor, who's associated with AAMC. And I think Dr. Cooper emailed the link to all of the incoming students. And one of the paragraphs in that letter, the idea of the letter was, when do you start becoming a member of the profession, that is, the medical profession? And it's, you know, is it when you graduate, when you become a resident? And Dr. Cantor was arguing that, no, it's the first day that you start. And one of the aspects that leads to that development of professionalism has to do with the study of anatomy, because you then have to start thinking not about yourself, but about what you're doing and how you're doing it. And I think that starts to address a number of the issues that were brought up in today's discussion, and that is, we, through that study, we come to know ourselves more, and we come to know a little bit more about others.
I think my only advice for an incoming student who's maybe nervous about gross anatomy is, don't be. It's actually going to be really fun, and I don't think I've ever had a student who was miserable in the course. The first day, everybody's a little nervous, and you're not alone. I would say almost 100% of the class is right there with you. But it becomes like one of the best experiences of your life very quickly. And it won't be long after it's over until you wish you could go back and do it again.
I think my advice would be to learn everything you can from the donors, because, you know, if you're apprehensive at first and you're not you're just kind of there, kind of going through the motions, getting that aspect of your day's work done, and then trying to, you know, learn off the dissector or learn from the nose or something, and you kind of miss out on how much more you can actually learn from the cadaver itself. And so if you don't discover that until halfway through the semester, not only probably will that reflect in your grades, but also just reflect in how much you learn in general, and just your general knowledge about the human body. And so I think it's important to, there's a lot of apprehension at first, but be able to overcome them, realize how important it is, and take advantage of it early on.
Yeah, I would definitely say agree with Nick on that one, and also add that I think keeping a journal throughout the anatomy course, and just kind of going through your own feelings, and you'll find a huge difference between when you started off the semester and when you ended this semester, just how you've grown as a person through your studies in all your classes, but especially through the anatomy lab.
I'm here with Leslie Harrington. And Leslie, what is your position in terms of the medical student research program?
Well, I'm currently the coordinator of the Iowa Medical Student Research Program. And I also happen to work with the medical scientist training program, which is the MD-PhD program.
Okay. So the medical student research program goes on here during the summer. Leslie, how many people would you say, or how many students participate in this program?
I would say we have over 125 students participating in summer research projects.
Okay. And is that like M1s only, or how's that divided up?
That is divided about a third into M1s or pre-M1s who came in the summer before their medical school started, and about two-thirds M1s or rising M2s at the time, I guess you would call them.
Okay. And so it occurs to me that maybe one of the real benefits of doing something like this is you develop some good mentorship here at Iowa. Can you comment on maybe some of the mentorship opportunities available through doing research here?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the strengths of this program, is to have students get involved and meet with faculty. We have a fabulous, very dynamic faculty on campus here at Iowa. We have over 200 faculty members who are willing to and would love to work with students in this capacity. And this summer, there are probably 125 faculty members who are represented at this research day.
Okay, very good.
Which is a protein of the extracellular matrix, and it's normally expressed in the basal membrane of stratified squamous epithelium, but sometimes it can be expressed in an immature form. And then when keratinocytes or other cells, squamous cells for example, come in contact with this unprocessed laminin, they can become motile. So this motility and this laminin dysregulation has been shown in past papers to be related to the invasive ability of squamous cell carcinomas.
If people have received tend to be older, and diabetes. If you have diabetes, it increases your risk of being hurt by 100%.
Did they know that before?
No. I mean, I didn't read it anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Awesome thing about the University of Iowa is there's just so much opportunity here that I was able to find a research project that, like, really fit what I was looking for.
So, Jerry, can you comment once more on maybe the breadth of research here? So what kind of breadth are you talking about?
Yeah, so we're talking about stuff that focuses on a cellular level, right up to primary care dynamics that occur in the ER. So over here we got Dr. Mike Takis looking with a number of students at different alcohol-related issues that walk into ER, particularly on Thursday nights. And we hope that no medical students are involved in that patient population.
Jerry was actually a research subject in that study.
That's correct. Right over to, we have a very nice mouse study over here, the effect of smoking on cellular division, and really, really interesting. Poster number 83, I found that to be fascinating.
Let me ask you, what value do you see in non-MSTP students doing summer research?
Well, I think it's great. I think academic medicine in general is really important, and I think it's important for medical students to understand kind of the breadth of care. And I think, of course, everything from the bench to the bedside is, of course, is important. And I know some schools encourage actually doing, you know, taking a year off or doing a thesis project. So I think at the very least we can have a summer where students can concentrate on this type of thing.
This is Natalie Ramirez, and we are starting our first episode of The Short Couch. The Short Couch is a segment that we're trying here to sort of answer questions about med school life, academics, personal life issues, in any sort of way possible, really, from people who have sort of charted this path before us, M3s, M4s, doctors, and sometimes M2s when the question pertains to something really, really a part of first year. Our first question today, it was written to the Short Couch coach, and the question is, this is a question I wrestled with during my first year of medical school, and frankly, I don't believe I've tackled it. During the first week of school, everyone is handing out free advice. This is what I heard, even coming from the counseling center at the time management session. Everyone feels as if he isn't studying enough, but be rest assured that you are. You need to go out and have fun too. Well, I definitely agree with the fun part, or else we'd all go insane. But here's my question. How do you know if you're really, truly studying enough? And also, for that matter, how do I know if I'm studying much more or less than my fellow medical students? So I'm joined today by two other medical students, and if they just introduce themselves right now.
My name is Amy Domeyer-Klensky. I am a third-year medical student.
And my name is Chris Yop. I am a second-year medical student.
And they're here with me today to sort of address this question. So I think this is a fun question because it's really more of an emotional question than it is something that we can answer concretely. And I sort of see two parts to it, which you guys could probably help address, which is the sort of how do you get over this feeling? How do you really know? Or how have you dealt with it? But then there's the other part to it, which is what are our goals at large in studying a whole lot? And so I feel like for most medical students, that comes into play when we're thinking about residency and residency matches and how much do our grades really matter? You know, where do we have to focus? So just to start, I wanted to mention that I was flipping through some residency selection books yesterday, and most of them essentially said that you should try to get grades in those courses that you feel are most pertinent to the field that you'd like to go into. But that mere mortals cannot honor most, if not, I mean, most of their classes, and you should simply try your best. So these are things that we've heard time and time again, which I think is why, because that information is so vague, I think that's why it's hard for us to really decide, you know, how much should we study? So what do you guys have to say?
I think it's a great question because I found myself on both sides of that issue. Last year, I got tons of unsolicited advice, you know, people telling me constantly, make sure you go out and party, you know, don't worry, you're going to fail a test, it'll be okay, it's not the end of the world. And this year, I find myself making the same exact comments to M1s who are who are having issues with really understanding exactly how they should approach the material. I think it's all a matter of expectations. And the way I look at it is lowered expectations. I'm an overachiever. I came into med school, you know, expecting 100% on everything. And, you know, first test, I got 100%. I was really proud of myself. It was fantastic. And then I didn't anymore. You kind of have to find a level of which you're really comfortable with, where you can kind of aim for. I have a friend who aims for passing, and that's what they aim for. And when they pass, they're very, very happy, and they feel as though they've accomplished their goals. I know other people who constantly try to honor everything, and they aim for it, and that's their goal that they find themselves. I think probably the most appropriate goal is the one where you don't quite get to that point where you feel that thumping in your chest, that like singles impending doom, that you manage to learn enough that you feel as though you have a grasp on the material, and yet at the same time are not depriving yourself of sleep. That's really a big one for me.
I asked myself this question very frequently, and it really hasn't stopped me from procrastinating and watching the Rachel Zoe Project on Tuesday night before my pediatrics exam, or doing any of the other things I love, even though I do want to do my best. So that usually finds me Thursday night cramming and Friday morning screaming when the oatmeal is exploding out of the microwave and I feel totally unprepared. But, you know, you do your best, you do what you can do without going insane, and then you wake up, you go to the test, and when it's over, it's over. And you just have to kind of be able to look back on it and say, well, I did the best I can. And if you didn't, then the next time, because we have a test every single week to change your strategies to make sure that you do better on the next one. I think it's a little different third year and fourth year than it is the first 2 years, because your grades are based more on evaluations and other things. It's not just exams. So studying is only part of it. I don't know that it's really an answerable question.
Yeah, I think that's kind of how I feel about it too. And when I talk to a lot of other people about it, even some M4s, they're like, geez, I don't even know if I'm studying enough still. Because it really is something that's sort of individualized. And like you mentioned, Chris, it all depends on your expectations, too, of how you want to do and where you want to succeed. And then the other part here where she asked about, you know, how do you know if you're studying more or less than your fellow students? How do you guys feel about that? Because
I found that whenever I've asked someone else how much they've studied, it's just led to me freaking out even more. Like, especially if they're studying more than me, then I get this incredible anxiety that I didn't study enough, when really, when it comes down to it, I'm probably studying enough for me, but their needs are different than mine. Also, it generally is pretty awkward, I think, when you ask someone like, oh, so how much have you studied? Or, oh, how'd you do on that test? Because if they did really well and you didn't, then you feel bad. Or if you did really well and they didn't, then they feel bad. So just in general, I think comparing yourself to someone else isn't the best option, and you just kind of have to go with your gut, I guess.
I totally agree. The real goal should be understanding as much as you can and being really comfortable with the material and feeling like you're as competent as you think you need to be. I was telling people earlier this story about a friend of mine who studies all the time. He studies and he studies and he studies. He doesn't let anybody know. He's a closet studier. The persona that he puts off is that he's constantly drinking. One would actually think he's an alcoholic, whereas the real crux of it is that he's a gunner to the max. It's hard. It's hard not to compare yourself to other people around, because you want to make sure you're doing as much as necessary. And of course, you're only comparison point are those around you. At the same time, it's often really inaccurate. You can't necessarily base where you should be with where they may be, because you really, to be honest, if you see somebody sitting down reading a book for 5 hours, you might not have noticed that they only turned the page once.
Mm-hmm. And I think remember too that everyone has a different learning style, so somebody reading the textbook might be very helpful for them, where other people drawing out pictures or speaking it with someone else or diagrams. I mean, everyone has a different way of learning. So don't think that someone else's way of learning is the way that you have to learn, because that's not the case. Everyone, you just need to do what's best for you.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like this question also sort of opens up to, what are we supposed to be learning in these, at least in the first 2 years, I think is where this is really predominantly addressed. You know, how much are we supposed to be learning? What are we supposed to be learning? Why are we learning it? You know, I mean, I guess there's the really concrete, United States medical licensing exam. So that's something that we're sort of working towards all the way until the end of second year. And then, as I mentioned before, there's this whole idea of matching into a particular program for residency, and those grades, either in your clerkships or in the first 2 years, really mattering. So I'm wondering how, you know, I guess, how do you guys feel about that, about sort of studying maybe to the USMLE, or, you know, what advice have you received also about residency matches and all that?
I study for the week.
Nice.
And usually after the week's over, it goes out the other ear. So studying for boards was like, oh, crap, I have to do this all over again. So if you're organized enough that you can, like, start studying for boards, like, while you're studying for your classes, like, bravo. But if you're not, you'll get through it, too. I mean, I don't know. I don't take myself too seriously, I guess, so.
You see, I'm a little different. I'm a long... I'm a long-term studier. I plot out a course and I think, like, what do I need to be studying?
Oh my God.
You know, that said, I sleep 8 hours a night.
It's like the Oregon Trail.
Oh
of
my God.
School.
Little Timmy died because I forgot to feed him. Yeah. Yeah. So I think about those long-term things, and it's kind of funny because I feel like I'm in the questioner's boat right now. To be honest, I don't really know exactly what I should be studying for. Everybody keeps getting told that your grades for your first 2 years don't matter. It's your board one scores.
Oh my gosh!
which is great for me. It makes me happy. But I'm happy only because I haven't taken the boards yet.
Yeah.
I don't know. Should I study for the board? Should I study to become incredibly competent in the material that I'm being presented with now? I'm going for the competency sort of thing right this second. Maybe board scores will come along with it. I don't know, but I'm looking at this semester walking out of pharmacology actually remembering at least 10 drugs.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah, right?
No, I think that makes a whole lot of sense. And, you know, from what I've read, you know, other little books too, you can see all the exact breakdowns of median USMLE scores for particular residencies, that sort of thing. Or this book that I was looking at was basically saying, like, if you want to go into pathology, it'd be really great to honor your pathology course. You know, and I think that makes sense too for, say, if you want to go into neuro, you know, honoring your neuroscience course and that sort of thing. Surgery, honor anatomy, you know, and I think what I liked that this book explained was just that most people aren't going to honor everything, you know, and always remembering that half of us are in the bottom of our class, you know, and that the more important thing really is to find where your interests lie and pursue those interests and hopefully reinforce them with good grades in those particular areas, and that should help get you where you want to go.
I sort of think of it as supply and demand. Like, the world needs pediatricians and family medicine doctors and yeah. OB-GYNs. And so, even if you don't honor things, the world still needs pediatricians and family doctors and OB-GYNs. So, you know, you're gonna get there. If you want to be a dermatologist, the world needs fewer dermatologists than family practitioners. Sorry, dermatology, I really enjoyed the rotation, but... so just kind of, like, think of it that way, and, you know, if you really want to be something that's uber competitive, then you have to go for it, but, you know, you can, we're all gonna get there.
Yeah, exactly. One way or another, somehow, they tell us we're gonna get MDs. All right, so what other sort of takeaway advice do you guys feel like? I feel like when she asks, when do you know you're truly, you know, studying enough, that whole thing, you're supposed to have that balance. I mean, I guess it sounds like all of us are saying you're never really going to know.
I think you know when you pass the test.
So, that's true.
And if you passed two tests for a given class or honored, if that's what you wanted to do, then you know that's how you study for that test. Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a trial and error kind of process.
Yeah, I mean, there are four-ish tests per class, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, as somebody who's an M1 going into the first test, the first two tests for biochem and anatomy are supposedly relatively easy. And so they're the, you know, the baby steps to really preparing everybody for medical school tests. And you just kind of, you gauge yourself, like, how much did you study? How well did you do? Where do you, what study habits have been working well for you? Whenever you walked away, did you do really well? If you did, keep up with what you've been doing. If you didn't, you need to adjust and change it. But yeah, again, I just want to say I have like the more global view when it comes to medicine. It's you've got like what I when I you've got the expectations for the class and of course the professors, you know, write these questions thinking that everybody should know the answers to all the questions, or they should walk away from the class knowing these answers. It, in many ways, you go into medicine not because you have to learn a finite set of facts. You go into it because you're constantly learning. You're never going to stop being a student. You learn for your first year anatomy, the basics. Then you go into second year pathology, pharm. Then you go into your clerkships and you go and you learn the fundamentals of whatever field. Then you go into your residency program and you learn even more fundamentals. And then you become an attending. And as an attending, you're still studying and going back and relearning different tasks and relearning the new ways of doing everything. It's never going to stop. You're never going to learn enough.
Yeah.
Well, and in that respect, you right now we're almost learning how to become a lifelong learner. Not necessarily that we need to like commit to memory for the rest of our lives every detail of pharmacology, because by the time you're a practicing physician, there are going to be new drugs to memorize and new things that you're going to need to know, and things are going to change. So right now, it's important for you, obviously, to pass the test, but then also to just learn how to learn and how to look things up and just be a productive learner, mm-hmm. I think. So.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think something else that this question is sort of getting at is take the idea that you're passing your classes. And so in theory, that should be saying that you're studying enough. But I think this is also asking, you know, how do you know if you're not pushing yourself exactly? You know, what if you just passed, but what if you should be capable of honoring? What if you should have honored? And I think that this is sort of asking, like, you know, if you just passed, was that really good enough? Was I really studying enough? Or should I be doing more? You know,
I think it's probably kind of like taking a medication. Like, you know, you'd start yourself off with the highest dose possible or maybe the lowest dose possible. And then you realize, yeah, there are a lot of side effects of this studying. Like, I'm not getting sleep. I feel like crap. My relationships are totally out of whack. Well, then you got to lower your dose a little bit until you find the happy medium. Or if you start with a low dose, maybe you want to increase it a little bit until you start feeling where the side effects are interfering with your life, and then stay at that happy medium. You know,
I love that this is going to be on my test on Friday. I feel like I'm reviewing right now. It's so true. I tried to allude to it before. Amy has a much better way of putting it. You know, there's that point when you start getting that tight feeling in your chest, or your relationships start dying.
Impending doom.
Exactly. Impending doom is a very common feeling. And you realize you haven't talked to your dad in 2 weeks, and oh my God, it was my sister's birthday yesterday, mm-hmm. Which reminds me, my sister's birthday is tomorrow. So, hey, you know, those various things, it's really, really difficult to kind of counterbalance everything. Everyone says balance, balance, balance. And I think no one's going to say 5 hours is enough for you. Each person has a different dosage of studying that they can handle. What we can say is that once you start seeing the side effects, once you start feeling, you know, anxiety, once you start realizing you're not talking to your old friends, once you realize you just don't have any time just to date anybody, or you don't have any time to you know, do what you enjoy, like exercising, then maybe you need to cut back a little bit. You are reaching your breaking points. And that's, once you reach your breaking point, there's really, it's very difficult to come back from mm-hmm. it. You find yourself, you know, becoming an extended student, or you find yourself having to take a summer course over again. And, you know, what you really need to figure out is that balance right there, your own personal balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds a lot like med school is just sort of this process of figuring out where your limits are and kind of coming to terms with that.
But ask for help if you need it too. Like, if you realize that I am like at maximal side effects and I'm still not doing a really great job in the class, ask for help because there are people around and other people have been through the same situation. You're not the first person to fail pharmacology exam or, sorry, Chris, did I mean to put anxiety
Thanks.
On because you have pharmacology
I appreciate that.
But you're not the first person to fail whatever test and you're not going to be the last. So if you need help, ask for it and find out what's the best way for you to learn the material.
Yeah.
There are certainly resources available.
Yeah, not everyone fails a test. But if you do, don't worry. Quite a few others did too.
Yeah.
And yeah, the resources are there. There's tutoring resources. There's the counseling center filled with wonderful ladies and lots of cookies. And then there's always your family. Don't forget them.
And if you fail one test, you're not going to fail the class necessarily either. So it's never too late to go seek out those resources.
Mm-hmm.
Well, great. That sounds like some nice first-year advice and hopefully something that the second years can listen to yet again. I want to thank you two for joining me for this first ever episode of The Short Couch, and I hope that everyone will listen the next time.
Thanks for listening to The Short Coat. The Short Coat is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, with support from medical student government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, you can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we're known as The Short Coat. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com. Or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. That's also where you can submit a question for our advice segment, The Short Couch. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our theme music is by Revolution Void from the album Increase the Dosage. Find them at www.revolutionvoid.com.